"The orders which you are about to receive have come from me," she said, standing above them on the iron stairs, speaking with resonant clarity. "The men who will issue them are acting under my instructions. The interlocking control system has broken down. It will now be replaced by human labor. Train service will be resumed at once." She noticed some faces in the crowd staring at her with a peculiar look, with a veiled resentment, and the kind of insolent curiosity that made her suddenly conscious of being a woman. Then she remembered what she wore, and thought that it did look preposterous. And then at the sudden stab of some violent impulse that felt like defiance and like loyalty to the full real meaning of the moment, she threw her cape back and stood in the raw glare of light under the sooted columns, like a figure at a formal reception, sternly erect, flaunting the luxury of naked arms, of glowing black satin, of a diamond, flashing like a military cross. "The tower director will assign switchmen to their posts. He will select men for the job of signaling trains by means of lanterns, and for the task of transmitting his orders. Trains will..." She was fighting to drown a bitter voice that seemed to be saying, "That's all they're fit for, these men, if even that. There's not a single mind left anywhere on Taggart Transcontinental. Trains will continue to be moved in and out of the terminal. You will remain at your posts until..." Then she stopped. It was his eyes and hair that she saw first. The ruthlessly perceptive eyes, the streaks of hair shaded from gold to copper that seemed to reflect the glow of sunlight in the murk of the underground. She saw John Galt, among the chain gang of the mindless. John Galt, in greasy overalls and rolled shirt sleeves. She saw his weightless way of standing, his face held lifted, his eyes looking at her as if he had seen this moment many moments ago. "What's the matter, Miss Taggart?" It was the soft voice of the tower director, who stood by her side, with some sort of paper in his hand. And she thought it was strange to emerge from a span of unconsciousness, which had been the span of the sharpest awareness she had ever experienced. Only she did not know how long it had lasted, or where she was, or why. She had been aware of Galt's face. She had been seeing in the shape of his mouth and the planes of his cheeks the crack-up of that implacable serenity which had always been his. But he still retained it in his look of acknowledging the breach, of admitting that this moment was too much even for him. She knew that she went on speaking because those around her looked as if they were listening, though she could not hear a sound. She went on speaking, as if carrying out a hypnotic order given to herself some endless time ago, knowing only that the completion of that order was a form of defiance against him, neither knowing nor hearing her own words. She felt as if she were standing in a radiant silence where sight was her only capacity, and his face was its only object, and the sight of his face was like a speech in the form of a pressure at the base of her throat. It seemed so natural that he should be here. It seemed so unendurably simple. She felt as if the shock were not his presence, but the presence of others on the tracks of her railroad, where he belonged, and they did not. She was seeing those moments aboard a train when, at its plunge into the tunnels, she had felt a sudden solemn tension, as if this place were showing her in naked simplicity the essence of her railroad and of her life, the union of consciousness and matter, the frozen form of a mind's ingenuity, giving physical existence to its purpose. She had felt a sense of sudden hope, as if this place held the meaning of all of her values, and a sense of secret excitement, as if a nameless promise were awaiting her under the ground. It was right that she should now meet him here. He had been the meaning and the promise. She was not seeing his clothing any longer, nor to what level her railroad had reduced him. She was seeing only the vanishing torture of the months when he had been outside her reach. She was seeing in his face the confession of what those months had cost him. The only speech she heard was as if she were saying to him, "This is the reward for all my days," and as if he were answering, "For all of mine." She knew that she had finished speaking to the strangers when she saw that the tower director had stepped forward and was saying something to them, glancing at a list in his hand. Then, drawn by a sense of irresistible certainty, she found herself descending the stairs, slipping away from the crowd, not toward the platforms and the exit, but into the darkness of the abandoned tunnels. "You will follow me," she thought, and felt as if the thought were not in words but in the tension of her muscles, the tension of her will to accomplish a thing she knew to be outside her power. Yet she knew with certainty that it would be accomplished, and by her wish. No, she thought, not by her wish, but by its total rightness. You will follow me. It was neither plea, nor prayer, nor demand, but the quiet statement of a fact. It contained the whole of her power of knowledge and the whole of the knowledge she had earned through the years. You will follow me if we are what we are, you and I, if we live, if the world exists, if you know the meaning of this moment and can't let it slip by as others let it slip, into the senselessness of the unwilled and unreached. You will follow me. She felt an exultant assurance which was neither hope nor faith, but an act of worship for the logic of existence. She was hurrying down the remnants of abandoned rails, down the long dark corridors twisting through granite. She lost the sound of the director's voice behind her. Then she felt the beat of her arteries, and heard in answering rhythm the beat of the city above her head. But she felt as if she heard the motion of her blood as sound, filling the silence, and the motion of the city as the beat inside her body. And far behind her she heard the sound of steps. She did not glance back. She went faster. She went past the locked iron door where the remnant of his motor was still hidden. She did not stop. But a faint shudder was her answer to the sudden glimpse of the unity and logic in the events of the last 2 years. A string of blue lights went on into the darkness over patches of glistening granite, over broken sandbags spilling drifts on the rails, over rusty piles of scrap metal. When she heard the steps coming closer, she stopped and turned to look back. She saw a sweep of blue light flash briefly on the shining strands of Galt's hair. She caught the pale outline of his face and the dark hollows of his eyes. The face disappeared, but the sound of his steps served as the link to the next blue light that swept across the line of his eyes, the eyes that remained held level, directed ahead. And she felt certain that she had stayed in his sight from the moment he had seen her at the tower. She heard the beat of the city above them. These tunnels, she had once thought, were the roots of the city and of all the motion reaching to the sky. But they, she thought, John Galt and she, were the living power within these roots. They were the start and aim and meaning. He too, she thought, heard the beat of the city as the beat of his body. She threw her cape back. She stood defiantly straight, as he had seen her stand on the steps of the tower, as he had seen her for the first time 10 years ago here under the ground. She was hearing the words of his confession, not his words, but by means of that beating which made it so difficult to breathe. You looked like a symbol of luxury, and you belonged in the place that was its source. You seemed to bring the enjoyment of life back to its rightful owners. You had a look of energy and of its reward together. And I was the first man who had ever stated in what manner these two were inseparable. The next span of moments was like flashes of light in stretches of blinded unconsciousness. The moment when she saw his face as he stopped beside her, when she saw the unastonished calm, the leashed intensity, the laughter of understanding in the dark green eyes, the moment when she knew what he saw in her face by the tight-drawn harshness of his lips, the moment when she felt his mouth on hers, when she felt the shape of his mouth both as an absolute shape and as a liquid filling her body, then the motion of his lips down the line of her throat, a drinking motion that left a trail of bruises, then the sparkle of her diamond clip against the trembling copper of his hair. Then she was conscious of nothing but the sensations of her body, because her body acquired the sudden power to let her know her most complex values by direct perception. Just as her eyes had the power to translate wavelengths of energy into sight, just as her ears had the power to translate vibrations into sound, so her body now had the power to translate the energy that had moved all the choices of her life into immediate sensory perception. It was not the pressure of a hand that made her tremble, but the instantaneous sum of its meaning, the knowledge that it was his hand, that it moved as if her flesh were his possession, that its movement was his signature of acceptance under the whole of that achievement which was herself. It was only a sensation of physical pleasure, but it contained her worship of him, of everything that was his person and his life. From the night of the mass meeting in a factory in Wisconsin, to the Atlantis of a valley hidden in the Rocky Mountains, to the triumphant mockery of the green eyes of the superlative intelligence above a worker's figure at the foot of the tower. It contained her pride in herself, and that it should be she whom he had chosen as his mirror, that it should be her body which was now giving him the sum of his existence, as his body was giving her the sum of hers. These were the things it contained. But what she knew was only the sensation of the movement of his hand on her breast. He tore off her cape, and she felt the slenderness of her own body by means of the circle of his arms, as if his person were only a tool for her triumphant awareness of herself, but that self were only a tool for her awareness of him. It was as if she were reaching the limit of her capacity to feel, yet what she felt was like a cry of impatient demand, which she was now incapable of naming, except that it had the same quality of ambition as the course of her life, the same inexhaustible quality of radiant greed. He pulled her head back for a moment to look straight into her eyes, to let her see his, to let her know the full meaning of their actions, as if throwing the spotlight of consciousness upon them for the meeting of their eyes in a moment of intimacy greater than the one to come. Then she felt the mesh of burlap striking the skin of her shoulders. She found herself lying on the broken sandbags. She saw the long, tight gleam of her stockings. She felt his mouth pressed to her ankle, then rising in a tortured motion up the line of her leg, as if he wished to own its shape by means of his lips. Then she felt her teeth sinking into the flesh of his arm. She felt the sweep of his elbow knocking her head aside and his mouth seizing her lips with a pressure more viciously painful than hers. Then she felt, when it hit her throat, that which she knew only as an upward streak of motion that released and united her body into a single shock of pleasure. Then she knew nothing but the motion of his body and the driving greed that went reaching on and on as if she were not a person any longer, only a sensation of endless reaching for the impossible. Then she knew that it was possible, and she gasped and lay still, knowing that nothing more could be desired, ever. He lay beside her on his back, looking up at the darkness of the granite vault above them. She saw him stretched on the jagged slant of sandbags, as if his body were fluid in relaxation. She saw the black wedge of her cape flung across the rails at their feet. There were beads of moisture twinkling on the vault, shifting slowly, running into invisible cracks like the lights of a distant traffic. When he spoke, his voice sounded as if he were quietly continuing a sentence in answer to the question in her mind, as if he had nothing to hide from her any longer, and what he owed her now was only the act of undressing his soul, as simply as he would have undressed his body. "This is how I've watched you for 10 years. From here, from under the ground, under your feet, knowing every move you made in your office at the top of the building, but never seeing you, never enough. 10 years of nights spent waiting to catch a glimpse of you here on the platforms when you boarded a train. Whenever the order came down to couple your car, I'd know of it, and wait, and see you come down the ramp and wish you didn't walk so fast. It was so much like you, that walk. I'd know it anywhere. Your walk, and those legs of yours. It was always your legs that I'd see first, hurrying down the ramp, going past me, as I looked up at you from a dark sidetrack below. I think I could have molded a sculpture of your legs. I knew them, not with my eyes, but with the palms of my hands when I watched you go by. When I turned back to my work, when I went home just before sunrise for the 3 hours of sleep which I didn't get. I love you, she said, her voice quiet and almost toneless, except for a fragile sound of youth. He closed his eyes as if letting the sound travel through the years behind them. 10 years, Dagny. Except that once. There were a few weeks when I had you before me in plain sight, within reach. Not hurrying away, but held still as on a lighted stage, a private stage for me to watch, and I watched you for hours through many evenings, in the lighted window of an office that was called the John Galt Line. And one night, her breath was a faint gasp. Was it you, that night? Did you see me? I saw your shadow on the pavement, pacing back and forth. It looked like a struggle. It looked like... She stopped. She did not want to say torture. It was, he said quietly. That night, I wanted to walk in, to face you, to speak, to... That was the night I came closest to breaking my oath. When I saw you slumped across your desk, when I saw you broken by the burden you were carrying. John, that night, it was you that I was thinking of. Only I didn't know it. But you see, I knew it. It was you all my life, through everything I did and everything I wanted. I know it. John, the hardest was not when I left you in the valley. It was
your radio speech, the day you returned?
Yes. Were you listening?
Of course. I'm glad you did it. It was a magnificent thing to do. And I knew it anyway.
You knew? About Hank Reardon?
Before I saw you in the valley.
Was it? When you learned about him, had you expected it?
No.
Was it?
She stopped. Hard? Yes, but only for the first few days. That next night. Do you want me to tell you what I did the night after I learned it?
Yes.
I had never seen Hank Reardon. Only pictures of him in the newspapers. I knew that he was in New York that night at some conference of big industrialists. I wanted to have just one look at him. I went to wait at the entrance of the hotel where that conference was held. There were bright lights under the marquee of the entrance, but it was dark beyond on the pavement, so I could see without being seen. There were a few loafers and vagrants hanging around. There was a drizzle of rain, and we clung to the walls of the building. One could tell the members of the conference when they began filing out by their clothes and their manner. Ostentatiously prosperous clothes, and a manner of overbearing timidity, as if they were guiltily trying to pretend that they were what they appeared to be for that moment. There were chauffeurs driving up their cars. There were a few reporters delaying them for questions, and hangers-on trying to catch a word from them. They were worn men, those industrialists, aging, flabby, frantic with the effort to disguise uncertainty. And then I saw him. He wore an expensive trench coat and a hat slanting across his eyes. He walked swiftly with the kind of assurance that has to be earned, as he'd earned it. Some of his fellow industrialists pounced on him with questions, and those tycoons were acting like hangers-on around him. I caught a glimpse of him as he stood with his hand on the door of his car, his head lifted. I saw the brief flare of a smile under the slanting brim, a confident smile, impatient and a little amused. And then for one instant, I did what I'd never done before, what most men wreck their lives on doing. I saw that moment out of context. I saw the world as he made it look, as if it matched him, as if he were its symbol. I saw a world of achievement, of unenslaved energy, of unobstructed drive through purposeful years to the enjoyment of one's reward. I saw, as I stood in the rain in a crowd of vagrants, what my years would have brought me if that world had existed. And I felt a desperate longing. He was the image of everything I should have been, and he had everything that should have been mine. But it was only a moment. Then I saw the scene in full context again, and in all of its actual meaning. I saw what price he was paying for his brilliant ability, what torture he was enduring in silent bewilderment, struggling to understand what I had understood. I saw that the world he suggested did not exist and was yet to be made. I saw him again for what he was, the symbol of my battle, the unrewarded hero whom I was to avenge and to release. And then, I accepted what I'd learned about you and him. I saw that it changed nothing, that I should have expected it, that it was right. He heard the faint sound of her moan, and he chuckled softly. Dagny, it's not that I don't suffer. It's that I know the unimportance of suffering. I know that pain is to be fought and thrown aside, not to be accepted as part of one's soul and as a permanent scar across one's view of existence. Don't feel sorry for me. It was gone right then. She turned her head to look at him in silence, and he smiled, lifting himself on an elbow to look down at her face as she lay helplessly still. She whispered, "You've been a track laborer here. Here. For 12 years. Yes.
Ever since?
Ever since I quit the 20th century.
The night when you saw me for the first time. You were working here then?
Yes. And the morning when you offered to work for me as my cook, I was only your track laborer on leave of absence. Do you see why I laughed as I did? She was looking up at his face. Hers was a smile of pain. His, of pure gaiety.
John.
Say it. but say it all.
You were here.
All those years.
Yes.
All those years. While the railroad was perishing, while I was searching for men of intelligence, while I was struggling to hold on to any scrap of it I could find, while you were combing the country for the inventor of my motor, while you were feeding James Taggart and Wesley Mooch, while you were naming your best achievement after the enemy whom you wanted to destroy. She closed her eyes.
I was here all those years, he said, within your reach, inside your own realm, watching your struggle, your loneliness, your longing, watching you in a battle you thought you were fighting for me, a battle in which you were supporting my enemies and taking an endless defeat.
I was here, hidden by nothing but an error of your sight, as Atlantis is hidden from men by nothing but an optical illusion.
I was here, waiting for the day when you would see, when you would know that by the code of the world you were supporting, it's to the darkest bottom of the underground that all the things you valued would have to be consigned, and that it's there that you would have to look.
I was here. I was waiting for you. I love you, Dagny. I love you more than my life. I who have taught men how life is to be loved. I've taught them also never to expect the unpaid for. And what I did tonight, I did it with full knowledge that I would have to pay for it, and that my life might have to be the price.
No.
He smiled, nodding.
Oh, yes. You know that you've broken me for once, that I broke the decision I'd set for myself. But I did it consciously, knowing what it meant. I did it, not in blind surrender to the moment, but with full sight of the consequences and full willingness to bear them. I could not let this kind of moment pass us by. It was ours, my love. We had earned it.
But you're not ready to quit and join me. You don't have to tell me, I know. And since I chose to take what I wanted before it was fully mine, I'll have to pay for it. I have no way of knowing how or when. I know only that if I give in to an enemy, I'll take the consequences.
He smiled in answer to the look on her face.
No, Dagny, you're not my enemy in mind. And that is what brought me to this. But you are, in fact, in the course you're pursuing, though you don't see it yet. But I do. My actual enemies are of no danger to me. You are. You're the only one who can lead them to find me. They would never have the capacity to know what I am.
But with your help?
They will.
No.
No, not by your intention. And you're free to change your course. But so long as you follow it, you're not free to escape its logic. Don't frown, the choice was mine. And it's a danger I chose to accept. I'm a traitor, Dagny, in all things. I wanted you. I had no power to change your decision. I had only the power to consider the price and decide whether I could afford it.
I could.
My life is mine to spend, or to invest. And you?
You're...
As if his gesture were continuing his sentence, he raised her across his arm and kissed her mouth, while her body hung limply in surrender, her hair streaming down, her head falling back, held only by the pressure of his lips.
You're the one reward I had to have, and chose to buy.
I wanted you. And if my life is the price, I'll give it. My life, but not my mind. There was a sudden glint of hardness in his eyes as he sat up and smiled and asked,
Would you want me to join you and go to work?
Would you like me to repair that interlocking signal system of yours within an hour?
No.
The cry was immediate, in answer to the flash of a sudden image, the image of the man in the private dining room of the Wayne Falkland. He laughed.
Why not?
I don't want to see you working as their serf.
And yourself?
I think that they're crumbling and that I'll win. I can stand it just a little longer.
True, it's just a little longer. Not till you win, but till you learn.
I can't let it go.
It was a cry of despair.
Not yet, he said quietly. He got up and she rose obediently, unable to speak.
I will remain here on my job, he said, but don't try to see me.
You'll have to endure what I've endured, and wanted to spare you. You'll have to go on knowing where I am, wanting me as I'll want you, but never permitting yourself to approach me. Don't seek me here. Don't come to my home. Don't ever let them see us together. And when you reach the end, when you're ready to quit, don't tell them. Just chalk a dollar sign on the pedestal of Nat Taggart's statue, where it belongs. Then go home and wait. I'll come for you in 24 hours. She inclined her head in silent promise. But when he turned to go, a sudden shudder ran through her body, like a first jolt of awakening, or a last convulsion of life, and it ended in an involuntary cry. Where are you going? To be a lamppost, and stand holding a lantern till dawn, which is the only work your world relegates me to, and the only work it's going to get. She seized his arm to hold him, to follow him blindly, abandoning everything but the sight of his face. John. He gripped her wrist, twisted her hand, and threw it off. No, he said. Then he took her hand and raised it to his lips, and the pressure of his mouth was more passionate a statement than any he had chosen to confess. Then he walked away, down the vanishing line of rail, and it seemed to her that both the rail and the figure were abandoning her at the same time. When she staggered out into the concourse of the terminal, the first blast of rolling wheels went shuddering through the walls of the building like the sudden beat of a heart that had stopped. The temple of Nathaniel Taggart was silent and empty, its changeless light beating down on a deserted stretch of marble. Some shabby figures shuffled across it as if lost in its shining expanse. On the steps of the pedestal, under the statue of the austere, exultant figure, a ragged bum sat slumped in passive resignation, like a wing-plucked bird with no place to go, resting on any chance cornice. She fell down on the steps of the pedestal like another derelict, her dust-smeared cape wrapped tightly about her. She sat still, her head on her arm, past crying or feeling or moving. It seemed to her only that she kept seeing a figure with a raised arm holding a light, and it looked at times like the Statue of Liberty. And then it looked like a man with sun-streaked hair holding a lantern against a midnight sky. A red lantern that stopped the movement of the world.
Don't take it to heart, lady, whatever it is,
said the bum in a tone of exhausted compassion.
Nothing's to be done about it anyway. What's the use, lady? Who is John Galt?
This book is continued on Disc 4.
Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Part 3 continued.
Disc 4.
Chapter 6. The Concerto of Deliverance. On October 20th, the Steelworkers Union of Reardon Steel demanded a raise in wages. Hank Reardon learned it from the newspapers. No demand had been presented to him, and it had not been considered necessary to inform him. The demand was made to the Unification Board. It was not explained why no other steel company was presented with a similar claim. He was unable to tell whether the demanders did or did not represent his workers, the board's rules on union elections having made it a matter impossible to define. He learned only that the group consisted of those newcomers whom the board had slipped into his mills in the past few months. On October 23rd, the Unification Board rejected the union's petition, refusing to grant the raise. If any hearings had been held on the matter, Reardon had not known about it. He had not been consulted, informed, or notified. He had waited, volunteering no questions. On October 25th, the newspapers of the country, controlled by the same men who controlled the board, began a campaign of commiseration with the workers of Reardon Steel. They printed stories about the refusal of the wage raise, omitting any mention of who had refused it or who held the exclusive legal power to refuse, as if counting on the public to forget legal technicalities under a barrage of stories implying that an employer was the natural cause of all misery suffered by employees. They printed a story describing the hardships of the workers of Reardon Steel under the present rise in the cost of their living, next to a story describing Hank Reardon's profits of 5 years ago. They printed a story on the plight of a Reardon worker's wife trudging from store to store in a hopeless quest for food, next to a story about a champagne bottle broken over somebody's head at a drunken party given by an unnamed steel tycoon at a fashionable hotel. The steel tycoon had been Orrin Boyle, but the story mentioned no names. Inequalities still exist among us, the newspapers were saying, and cheat us of the benefits of our enlightened age.
Privations have worn the nerves and temper of the people. The situation is reaching the danger point. We fear an outbreak of violence. We fear an outbreak of violence, the newspapers kept repeating.